This program is sponsored by Blazing Grace Ministries.
This radio program is PG-13. Parents strongly caution some material may be inappropriate for children under the age of 13. Set me free. Of the chains holding me.
Is anybody out there hearing me? Set me free.
Jesus' mission was to comfort those who mourn, bind up the brokenhearted, proclaim liberty to captives, and open prison doors for those who are bound. For those who want more than status quo Christianity has to offer, Blazing Grace Radio begins now. And here is your host, Mike Janung.
Hey, Mike Janung here. Welcome back to Blazing Grace Radio, broadcasting from Phoenix, where these days we're getting our 110-degree plus weather and there's just nothing like walking outside and getting into an oven. So thank you for joining us. Last week we talked to Dr. Anna Lemke, and this week we bring her back. She is the professor of psychiatry at Stanford University School of Medicine and chief of the Stanford Addiction Medicine Dual Diagnosis Clinic. She has testified before the U.S. House of Representatives and the Senate and has served as an expert witness in federal and state opioid litigation, and she is an internationally recognized leader in addiction, medicine, treatment, and education. Anna, welcome back to the program.
Thank you for having me back. It's a pleasure to be here.
Thanks. So I'm going to read a statement from your book, Dopamine Nation, Finding Balance in the Age of Indulgence, which I do recommend, which I think might sum up a lot of what we face in what you call the age of indulgence. You write, "The paradox is that hedonism, the pursuit of pleasure for its own sake, leads to anhedonia," I don't know if I said that right, "which is the inability to enjoy pleasure of any kind." How do I say it right?
Yeah, it was perfect. Anhedonia, yep.
Okay. "Which is the inability to enjoy pleasure of any kind." And when I read that, I thought, the pursuit of pleasure, and it seems to me in our culture that's a lot of our struggles. We're pursuing pleasure without understanding what mode we're in. So what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, that is a big problem in modern life. We now have come to a place in human history that is unprecedented in the sense that we have, our survival needs met. We really don't have to do anything or much of anything in order to have food, clothing, shelter, find a mate. And at the same time, much of modern life has become drugified in some way, that is to say, made more potent, which means it releases dopamine and even more dopamine in the brain's reward pathway. That's our pleasure and reward neurotransmitter. It's more accessible. And when we think of digital media as a drug, which I do, the smartphone has essentially become the equivalent of the hypodermic syringe. We're just delivering digital dopamine 24/7 for our wired generation. Drugs have become more novel, meaning that we can change them, through technology and bioengineering. And novelty is one of the ways to overcome tolerance. And then quantity. We have sort of more of everything. And so, one might have thought that in a world in which we no longer need to focus on immediate survival, where we have more leisure time, more disposable income than ever before, even for the poorest of the poor living in rich nations, that we would spend our time, reading philosophy, helping other people, enjoying nature, cleaning the planet, but instead it looks like what we're doing is a lot of shopping, a lot of video games, a lot of pornography. And ironically, paradoxically, however you want to refer to it, I sometimes call it the pleasure paradox, we are unhappier than ever. We have more people struggling with depression, anxiety. Rates of depression, anxiety are going up all over the world, but they're going up fastest in rich nations. These are the very same nations where people have the most access to mental health treatment, where we're prescribing the most antidepressants, all of which suggests that we're getting something fundamentally wrong about mental health. And the thing that I would suggest we're getting wrong is that our lives are, in some paradoxical way, not too hard, but in fact too easy, or not hard in the right kinds of, ways. And that, you know, what we really need to do to improve our mental health is to acknowledge that we are evolutionary strivers. We are wired for suffering. And that we need to build back into our lives some element of proper striving or proper suffering or proper acceptance of suffering and pain, rather than inculcating this idea, as we have for the last several generations, that somehow if we're living our life properly, everything should feel wonderful and we should be ecstatic all the time. And that if we're uncomfortable, something's wrong, and on and on. Mm.
You shared how at one point you were on Prozac and at some point you got off it. And you make an interesting point what these medications, antidepressants, anti-anxiety meds do to the personality, and how you realize that getting off it and being who you are was a greater benefit than, to use my words, feeling better. Talk about that.
Yeah. So, I mean, first I want to acknowledge that I am very grateful that we have these psychiatric medications. I think that in many instances they can be vital and life-saving. I prescribe them often to patients struggling with severe mental health disorders. But I use myself as an example, as well as some anecdotal examples of other patients, to demonstrate that they're not for everybody. Number one, they don't help everybody, and they have side effects. So, you know, folks who are on psych meds and they're not helping and they're just experiencing side effects, that's a problem. We generally probably over-prescribe them in mental health treatment, or go to them too quickly before trying other more holistic approaches. And finally, that there are, for some people, actual mental health costs. And one of the potential costs is a kind of a sort of numbing phenomenon, or a lack of motivation, or an inability to have deeper feelings like grief and awe. And I think philosophically, we should reflect on what we're saying about ourselves when we're turning to medications to try to eliminate suffering. Because essentially what we're saying is pain is bad. And again, I want to acknowledge that people with life-threatening mental health disorders, I'm so glad that these medications are there to save lives. But on the other hand, you know, for people who don't necessarily need them, maybe the idea that we should not suffer is a wrong-headed one. And instead, you know, maybe we should embrace our unhappiness, as from that, you know, potentially comes a deeper sense of awe, and understanding of life, a deeper connection to our spiritual selves, especially if we can give some meaning to our suffering.
Mm. This is a quote from your book. You write, "When we first stop using dopamine to escape those painful thoughts, emotions and sensations come crashing down on us. The trick is to stop running away from painful thoughts, emotions and sensations, and instead allow ourselves to tolerate them." So that sounds like embracing pain and not checking out from it.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, for some of my patients struggling with severe depression, for example, sometimes the relief comes for them when they stop looking for the magic pill that will take away that suffering, and instead just sort of accept what is, and accept that suffering, including for some people very profound suffering, will just simply be a part of their lives.
In your section of the book called The Pursuit of Pain, you talk about cold showers. And before we get too much further, I just want to know, have you tried the cold shower yet?
I have tried cold showers, and they're very painful for me without much benefit. So I don't do them with any kind of regularity, but I often speak to both patients and just other people who tell me that cold showers are incredibly effective for them to change their mood and make them feel better. So it talks to this, the whole concept of drug of choice. That's what's reinforcing or works for one person may not work for another. So it's important to kind of experiment.
Yeah, I tried the cold showers after I read that, and I'd heard it before in Europe, but the first time I think I tried the last 20 seconds of a shower in cold and then worked my way up to the whole thing, but that took a little time.
And does it work for you? Does it help?
It gave me a little boost in the beginning, but then after a while it seemed like there wasn't a benefit, so.
Yeah, so it just shows, you know, everybody's different. I just talked yesterday with somebody who was telling me how much cold showers are just a lifesaver for him. So it's interesting to see how people are different.
So I'm going to read another quote to get into another area here. And you said the average adult tells between 0.59 and 1.56 lies a day. Liar, liar, pants on fire. We've all got a little smoke coming off our shorts. And when I read that, I first thought, nah, I don't tell one lie a day. But then I started thinking, how many times have I been in church and they do that thing to tell you to greet someone? And what does everybody say? They put a fake smile on. They say, hey, how you doing? And if I'm not doing well, I don't tell them how I'm doing. I fake it too, and because I don't know these people, and so I realized it's right. The average, we just don't understand it. So talk about lying and how that affects addiction, really, all of life.
Yeah, so I love your example, because it's a great example of a subtle lie that we justify to ourselves by telling ourselves that it would burden other people, and so we're actually protecting other people. Often we tell these little lies also to protect ourselves. You know, for example, one of the little lies that I'm prone to is exaggerating quantities or underreporting. For example, if I had to wait for somebody for 5 minutes and I'm irritated, I go home and I tell my husband kind of reflexively, oh, I had to wait for this person for 15 minutes. Well, it wasn't 15, it was 5. But my irritability isn't really justified, you know, by 5 minutes of waiting, but it feels justified for 15 minutes of waiting. So I exaggerate or change the story to kind of justify my desire to be upset. Also, false flattery is a very common and often underappreciated form of lying, where we're telling somebody something positive about them that we don't really believe or feel. I think all of these little lies, their cumulative effect of them can be very negative in our lives, and also very negative to our bonds with others. And in my work with people with severe addiction who have gotten into long-term recovery from their addictions, one of the recurring themes is that they have learned they must tell the truth. Mm. Not just tell the truth about their addictive behaviors, but tell the truth about everything. Even little things like what they had for breakfast or why they were, 5 minutes late or couldn't go out to a party or what have you. And I just got really curious and interested in that. Like, what is it about truth-telling that promotes recovery? And I think it works on many different levels. First of all, it works on the level of interpersonal intimacy. Although in the short term, lying to folks at church or where have you feels like it kind of improves human connection, mostly because we're worried that if we really reveal ourselves that people won't want to be close to us. The irony is that when we really do reveal to other people our shortcomings or our sadness, our grief, our general unhappiness, it actually makes people feel closer to us because, of course, they're experiencing similar things. So there's this funny thing where we're afraid to tell the truth about ourselves and our faults, and expose ourselves in that way because we were afraid that we'll end the relationship. But in fact, the opposite happens, and really that's what creates intimacy. The other way in which, you know, telling the truth really helps helps a thriving life and helps a recovery from addiction is that when we tell the truth to other people, we also become aware of it ourselves. And then we're not living in that state of denial where we can pretend that it's not happening. And that awareness is really important for giving us better access to all of the data that we need in order to make better decisions. Like if we're pretending that something isn't happening, then believe it or not, in our brain, it's not happening. And so then we're kind of blindly fumbling around trying to improve our lives, but our brain doesn't have all of the information it needs to go on a better path. And I talk about, you know, many other levels in which what I call radical honesty is so important. Radical honesty is also probably contagious, just like lying is contagious. Many of my patients with severe addiction grew up in households where family members lied. And that kind of thing can really have an insidious and very harmful effect on family systems and relationships. That make people feel like they can't really rely on or trust other people. And so, hence, that then further contributes to this kind of survival mode where it's like, oh, I need to take whatever I can get for myself right now because I can't rely on others.
Mm. You use the words post-truth culture in your book, and that really kind of hit me in perspective that, I mean, without getting too far down the line with politics, I mean, and media, we get saturated with lies every single day. And as you mentioned, living in a post-truth culture, it's almost becoming, you don't know what to believe and how that affects us. And so how does living in a post-truth culture affect us in, from your view?
Well, I mean, I think it's why we're seeing broadly in society that people have lost trust in a lot of our human institutions. They've lost trust in politics and in politicians. They've lost trust in religious organizations. They've lost trust in the educational system, right? There's that whole Varsity Blues scandal where, you know, parents paid for their kids to have fake higher SAT scores or what have you. There's this sort of general sense that, wow, you know, nothing is really, you can't rely on anything anymore to be what it pretends to be. And that's really like a huge problem, right? Because so much of civilization and society relies on trust that, you know, people are going to do what they said they were going to do, that this dollar that I'm being paid with is actually a dollar. And then it has a dollar's value worth of buying power, you know, and on and on and on. It's just the very fabric of society relies on trust. And in the absence of that trust, again, people go into kind of survival mode. You get very tribal. Now they're now very focused on what's mine and what's ours and how can I take more from others and keep what I have. And it's just a very negative and insidious degradation of the social fabric.
Mm. Yeah, that's well said. I mean, the tribes, you see that on social media everywhere where people get upset about a lot easily.
Yeah, right. Well, and again, some of that is social signaling at a distance, right? Because we're now making these bonds with people who share our belief systems but don't live right next to us. And so we have to make it more extreme for a more obvious signal of which tribe we're in. But you know, that's just all kind of like tribal signaling rather than actually being problem solving.
Mm. So recently there was an article that came out. The headline was Tucson Teacher Quits Job Over Cell Phone Addiction The students couldn't put it down, their cell phones. And this is from a Wall Street Journal interview of the teacher. He said, this year something shifted. And it's just like my students are numbing themselves. They are just checking out of society.
Mm-hmm.
They just can't get rid of it. They won't put it away. I would walk up to kids and say, give me your phone. And they would clutch it. And I would say, that's what an alcoholic would do if you try to take away their bottle.
Right.
So this was a teacher of high school students, and they just wouldn't give it up. So when you hear that, what goes through your mind?
Well, I thank you for speaking up is what goes through my mind. I mean, I 100% agree that we have reached a kind of critical moment where it has become very clear that these digital devices and digital media are drugs, and that we need to create guardrails, especially for kids, so that they can use the useful aspects of the technology, but not be harmed by the clearly harmful aspects. And so, as I have said for many years now, schools, including public schools, through high school, should have a top-down policy of no smartphones in the school, and that the local and state and federal governments should incentivize this through various funding policies, just as we've incentivized highways when states raise their drinking laws to age 21. And furthermore, anecdotally, what we're hearing from schools that do have a top-down policy of no smartphones is that their mental and emotional well-being of their students immediately improves, that schools are noisy again because kids are interacting with each other, that kids are more free to focus and learn, and teachers are more free to teach them. So this is, to me, an obvious policy intervention that isn't all that hard to implement, and that if we have the will to acknowledge the harm of, in particular, the mobile devices during school hours, we could quite easily make this change effective, and it would be a huge positive.
Mm. Yeah, I think that's well said. Of course, the struggle is when the kid goes home and mom and dad are ignoring them because their head is down on their phone, that doesn't help.
Right. I mean, I always say to parents, you need to model the behavior that you want your children to have, and that means creating digital-free spaces, digital-free family time. Mealtime should be a place without devices. There should be a set time at night when devices are turned off, and that should apply to everybody. Devices shouldn't be in bedrooms. I mean, all kinds of self-binding strategies that families can engage in. And, frankly, that the corporations that make and profit from these devices need to help parents be able to implement these limits. It can't be left up to families and parents alone. Yes, parents and individuals have a responsibility to manage their consumption, but these devices and the digital media is so addictive, so cognitively adherent, that if we don't make it easier for people to establish guardrails, especially when it comes to kids, we're not taking care of each other the way that we should.
So, Anna, we got 1 minute left, and this has been wonderful, the things you've shared these last 2 weeks. So the mic is yours. Take a minute, share anything you want.
Yeah, I'll just close with the same message as before, that people, even with severe addictions, can get into long-term recovery, could completely transform their lives. So if you're somebody struggling with addiction, or if you're a family in crisis around your digital devices, there's hope. Don't stop fighting the good fight. Reach out for help. Things can get better.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you. I do appreciate you taking your time out and joining us for these last two shows.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.
And I love your book, and keep doing what you're doing.
Thank you.
All right, my friends, thank you for joining us, and we'll see you next time.
Do you want to be free?
Blazing Grace is a nonprofit international ministry for the sexually broken and the spouse. Please visit us at blazinggrace.org for information on Mike Janung's books, groups, counseling, or to have Mike speak at your organization. You can email us at email@blazinggrace.org or call our office in Chandler, Arizona at 719-888-5144. Again, visit us at blazinggrace.org. Email us at email@blazinggrace.org or call the office at 719-888-5144.
This program was sponsored by Blazing Grace Ministries.